Dark Wings.
Dark Words.
The Game of Thrones Podcast.
Season 2, Episode 1.
The North Remembers. Thank you for joining us for our inaugural episode recorded at a new location. Before we get into those details, I will introduce my new cast members, podcast members. That sounds dirty. I am your host, Chuck Davis, and with me this week are...
Philip Jonak, Esquire.
Mike Herger.
Craig McCallie.
Thanks, fellas. We are here at the good graces of Mike Herger, who is hosting this particular viewing party scenario. You guys, the three of you all gathered here to watch season one together, right?
Correct.
Yep.
And Mike, had you read the books prior to viewing season one?
I was reading it as season one was going along.
All right, so you jumped in and said, I'm going to do this before you'd seen anything on the screen.
Right.
At Craig's behest, did Craig play it up for you or what?
Craig got me originally into it, and then you and a couple other friends were like, oh, yeah, you need to read this. And
that's right. I've been promoting this show for years. If to those who I thought would be remotely
the show or
interested,
the books
for sure. Yeah, obviously, I was promoting the idea of the show before the show existed to no one.
There you go.
The show exists because of Chuck.
I theoretically one could say that I willed it into existence because I've been a big fan of other HBO series like Rome in particular, and I felt like this show could easily be the next Rome, and it is. And I felt that, and I made it happen.
Thank you, Chuck.
Much like I made all the dick scenes in Oz happen, that was all me.
that was a dark time in your life.
You really can will something into existence, or lots of things.
Or lots of dicks.
Alright, so just for a frame of reference, Craig and I at this point have both completed all of the A Song of Ice and Fire books through Dance with Dragons, which just came out last summer. And we both just, in the past couple months finished them.
Yep.
And Mike is working his way through A Storm of Swords.
Yep, I'm probably halfway through that right now, at least.
And Phil has no intention of ever reading the books.
Words are complicated.
he's illiterate.
So, different perspectives, got a few...
That's right. Well, it was always my intent to have a contributor who hadn't read the book so that we would have that point of view. And
glad to make you feel whole.
That's right. Phil is realizing that particular dream as we speak.
Chuck has read the books a couple times. I've read them once. Mike is part of the way through it, and Phil does not know how to read. So,
that's true.
All bases covered.
That is kind of all bases. But luckily, since Phil doesn't care that much about being spoiled, I think we won't make him leave the room when we enter spoiler territory. But I think this season we will redouble our efforts to at least have a spoiler-free first segment of every episode of Dark Wings, Dork Words.
I'll try hard. We'll see.
So, not to put you on the spot as our newbie podcast participant, but Phil, just as a viewer who'd had no idea what was going to happen, why don't you give us your initial impression?
Of this episode.
Or you could give us some background. Whatever. Speculate away.
Well, it's been quite a while since we have joined Game of Thrones, so the kind of flashbacky deal they did helped a little bit.
Previously
get back
on Game
up
of
to
Thrones.
Speed. One thing I noticed they do a lot in the show is they don't leave any storyline behind. They touch on everything. I guess they have an hour to do whatever they're doing, so...
It's obvious that they're jumping from, like, one sort of location and plot thread to another, right?
Well, they show a comet scene, yeah. You know, you're changing.
How did you like that, sort of the red comet in the sky as sort of a common thread for the different locations?
I guess, you know, good tie-in. I have no idea if that has any significance outside of what I saw on TV, but it could just be a segue trick as far as I'm concerned. But.
Or a harbinger of doom.
Did we see the Red Comet at the tail end of last season? Does anyone remember?
I don't think so.
I don't remember.
The Red Comet's a completely new thing that they just sort of... Who mentions it first?
It appears in the sky, right?
Was it in a dream? In Bran's dream first, I think?
It was Bran's dream first.
When the reflection in the pool, maybe, or he looks up. Yeah.
What did you think of Bran's dream, for instance?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of weird how seeing a comet in his dream, bam, the comet's there. Shit's happening. Normally when we have dreams, like we were joking earlier, we're in our old house, but it's not really our old house. We're in
high school. But it's not high school. It's also like a bowling alley.
Bran's tripping out on some shit. Like, you know, he's just dreaming clairvoyant here.
Well, Bran's dreams were sort of focal point of last season, mm-hmm. right? He kept having the dream of the three-eyed crow.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, it was just a crow.
It wasn't a focal point. It was a kind of a recurring
theme.
Something that you knew elements? Would be fleshed out later.
But you didn't really know.
The beginning of an arc, maybe?
The teaser.
They really took their time building up to the reveal of the three-eyed crow.
Yeah.
And it unfortunately didn't have the same significance as it does in the books, but at least it's one thing this show is good at doing is working in all the most important elements. That's one of the most fun things about watching this show, having read the books, is which elements, you know, realizing which decisions they made of what they keep and what they don't keep. And
what a tough job, by the way.
That's true.
I mean, it's like when Phil just said, you know, they really, and I realize he's right, they really do, for a person who's watching just the show, they do jump around a lot because there's a lot to hit, and people who've read the books know that they still don't cover a third of it. Well, half of it, maybe. So, yeah.
Because how many episodes are they going to do this year? Is it going to be the
same? I think it's like, 10 again, yeah.
Which, that's pretty hard to cover, like, you know, like a 1,000-page book and...
Right.
10 episodes.
Because the books get longer as they go along. The first one, I think, is the shortest. But they did a good job of covering most of the stuff that mattered. Where they fell short was just kind of budgetary things that they couldn't fully depict the epic scope of some battles and locations.
And maybe that's going to change this year because...
Big money show now.
I think, yeah it's pretty...
I don't know if the budget has increased at all.
God, you'd think it would have after...
I think they decided to do it about more expensive than most shows to begin with.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I think so.
So now they're just staying on budget?
Well, one thing that they talked about between seasons, one thing that... the producers promised is that they would do CGI wolves this time instead of trying to deal with actor wolves or actor dogs, essentially.
Well, I think the wolves are so large that you can't really...
Well, that was the worry. Are the dire wolves not going to get any bigger than huskies?
Yeah.
And thank goodness...
Because everybody knows someone with a husky. No big deal.
How dire can a husky be?
It worked pretty well, I think.
I think it did work. I mean,
However, the dragons are real
they're
now.
They're definitely CGI in this season.
The dragon, you know, I was disappointed that they didn't have at least an establishing shot that she has three dragons.
Yeah, they've only shown the one.
Didn't they last at the end of the last season? She had
or at least two of them.
You see the one kind of crawl up on her shoulder and squawk. And then you pull back and you can see that the other two dragons are there too, right?
So that's something.
That was the one establishing shot, but I mean...
I wish
they spent plenty of time lingering on that one dragon. They could have at least reminded the viewers that there are a couple others in those other cases.
Maybe there's a reason for that that will become clear. Who knows?
Again, I think it's just budgetary, that it just costs more money to show more CGI on the screen.
Well, that's the reason.
I know, but I don't like that reason.
I don't like it either.
I want budget to be damned, and I want...
I want three dragons!
Often.
in every shot,
yep.
For whatever reason.
All right, so Phil, tell me a little bit about what your impressions are of the major players this season.
I don't know. Shit kind of got turned around a little bit already in episode one.
In what way?
The guy that runs the whorehouse comes to mind.
Littlefinger.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Baelish. He seemed to have
Lord
the upper
Littlefinger.
Hands when he betrayed Ned Stark.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically, you could say, he single-handedly was responsible for turning King's Landing over to the Lannisters to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Cersei puts him in his place in a very...
easy-to-understand fashion.
very...
no two ways to take it.
What did that scene accomplish, really? It sort of... like Peter Baelish says, knowledge is power, which is kind of at the root of his whole character.
That's his MO, yeah.
And then Cersei shows power is power, which is really the root of her MO. So that was a very character-strengthening scene that didn't occur in the books at all. And that was
nothing,
one of the...
nothing in the books?
Well, it's true to both characters, so it helps flesh them both out in appropriate ways, but the events that unfolded in that scene never occurred in the books.
I was trying to think of if that was in the books, and I didn't remember it, but then I was like, maybe I just forgot it, but yeah, I thought it wasn't in there.
I think Varys would be more of a person to say knowledge is power, and Littlefinger would be a person to say personality or subterfuge.
Blackmail.
Yeah, it's something, yeah. Seediness is power.
Well, one thing that the show has done that's not necessarily true to the books is have Littlefinger too eager to sort of show his hand,
right?
You know, he's much more shrewd and hard to read in the books.
Yeah,
but he seems a little too eager to sort of monologue about his maniacal plans
right.
a little bit. I mean, not maybe that's overstating it a little bit, because I would think they did a good job of the scene where he betrays Ned in the throne room in front of Joffrey. That was a good twist.
Yeah,
and in truth, when he grabs Ned and holds the blade to his neck, I didn't remember having read that. I sort of thought he just sort of faded into the crowd and let the gold cloaks do the work.
But that was in the book.
And I thought they just did that to emphasize that, yes, this is me betraying you. But it was in the book,
yeah.
So I remember that incorrectly.
I was kind of expecting more dragon power from the Khaleesi.
Well, that's just
more
it.
Domination, and her
well,
people are withering away now in a desert. You know, if you have dragons at your hands, can't you just make water and food? And that's how dragons work.
Let's take it back to season one. Like, if you recall, in the premiere episode, the opening sequence depicts the others, right? Like
mm-hmm.
the dead coming to life and killing people, and you see the other.
Yeah, you kind of
and then you don't see
that
again for the rest. You do forget about it, right?
Right.
So I think that's kind of the case with the dragons a little bit. Like, you know, sure, they tease that there's dragons now, but they establish early on that they're small and weak, and she doesn't even know how to feed them.
Yeah.
Remember, too, she's a child still.
And at least two of them are going to be off-screen at all times.
Yeah, she's just a kid.
They did a good job of showing her sort of young and weak and out of her element and relying on Jorah Mormont.
Mm-hmm. And they revisited that in this episode, is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really did.
Yep.
She really goes back and forth like anyone who that young, who had that sudden position of power would probably have that struggle, you know.
For sure, yeah. I mean, that's her MO too, you know. It's just kind of coming from being a scared little girl into fulfilling her destiny.
Yep.
And that's definitely fun to watch. So we're still going to get into more book comparisons and in-depth stuff along those lines, but I want to milk Phil for as many sort of ignorant of the book details as we can. What about just the what about Tyrion? Tell us about Tyrion's role.
Well, I guess that's about the Tyrion we expect, or know and expect, too.
But Tyrion was just kind of like on the defense. Well, he started off sort of cavalier for at least the first 4 or 5 episodes, and then Catelyn takes him hostage.
Yeah.
And he's fighting for, he's using his wits to save his life, and there's a quick glance of Bronn, so you know that he's still around.
I love how he's just playing off his battle experience too here.
That was a little cocky of him to.
It's almost like he believes it, you know.
Call Joffrey out for not being part of the battle when he himself was knocked out for it.
That was not in the book.
That was another budgetary decision.
Yeah, they're just like, knock him out and wake him up when everything's happened.
Tyrion actually did ride into battle and
slew a few.
Availed himself nobly.
Did he slew other little people?
I was wondering if part of them not having the battle at all, besides being budgetary, was how they were going to, you know, convincingly display him charging into battle and hewing off arms and
legs.
Well,
just Achilles tendons all day long.
Well, I think in the first book he gets like a couple of guys to yield or something like that. And
with his wit.
If I recall correctly, they don't have armor that fits him.
Right.
So they sort of piecemeal together some armor for him. And so he's wearing a helm that has, like, a spike on it.
Right.
Like a unicorn horn type thing, or maybe just, like, a spike straight up or whatever. And so at some point, doesn't he impale another guy's horse on his horn or something?
Yeah, I think falls on him and he...
The horse, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's like, just sort of...
Oh, yeah, and then I think that's maybe how they find him at the end.
But he does have another knight on his back after that point, and he holds his axe up to... Or I think he's wielding an axe.
Yeah.
And gets him to yield.
Yep.
So that was kind of his heroic moment. So that was highly disappointing that they robbed the character of all of that.
Right.
Well, as if everybody didn't like him enough, you know, watching the show.
Which, yeah, from the book, I mean, he's a lot like... How he looks in the show is completely different from...
They've made everybody, almost everybody in the show, better looking. Almost every man, except for Jaime, they've made better looking than they were described in the book. And in the book, Tyrion was not hideous, but he was ugly. And
pretty hideous.
Mormont was gross looking and all, you know, non-appealing.
Jorah Mormont, he at least was sort of old and heavy.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, well, I think, I know they several times just described him as unattractive, you know, through one person's eyes or another.
And, you know, I guess so, yeah. But, I mean, through his actions, he's heroic.
Awesome. Yeah, totally.
Well, up to the point where, I don't know, he has some dark moments.
Spoiler alert.
Don't spoil it. Well, I mean, everybody, well.
But you're right, Peter Dinklage as an actor is far more dashing than the imp.
Right.
I mean, it's almost unfair for them to depict characters, like ridiculing Tyrion to the extent that they do. Just for being a little person, when Tyrion himself, you know, he had like the mismatched eyes and sort of the misshaped forehead and the limp and all that stuff.
Can I say this? If I can't, just edit this out. There's a point later where he becomes, something happens to him and
he
becomes
fucked up.
Less attractive. He gets fucked up. And I wonder if they're not going to
dumb that
down a little bit or skip it altogether, maybe
I think
a scar or something, you know.
I get the sense that they're not going to make him look ugly for the last 5 seasons of this show.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's still Hollywood.
They made the choice. A lot of characters are more handsome. Davos, for instance, was introduced this episode. Let's talk a little bit about the establishing of a new group of characters on Dragonstone, which they sort of reveal in the title sequence. You see the little clockwork glimpse of Dragonstone, which is where Stannis Baratheon resides.
I was kind of wondering trying to remember if we'd gotten into any of this or that.
These are all new characters.
Yeah, last season and all, and I couldn't really remember anything, but that's not saying much.
Basically, there's Stannis, and then there's the Red Priestess, who I don't even know if they mentioned her name in this episode.
I don't think they
did.
No,
they don't say,
And then there's the old Maester, and it's not even clear that he's a Maester, right?
He just looks like a ranting dude.
Just an old ranting guy who has the freedom to speak his mind in front of Lord Stannis.
And not get struck down somehow.
I guess the only reason he would know is kind of because he's got the chain, but, I mean...
Does he? Did he?
Yeah.
Can you see the chain clearly in certain scenes?
It just showed it.
Okay. Yeah, right, we're replaying the episode as we record this to prompt us to remember things. Since we struggled for a good hour, probably, to get our USB mic to work.
To not work.
Exactly. Yeah. So, this is our fallback device. So if you don't like the quality of our voices, tune in next week, and they may or may not improve.
I don't think mine will ever improve.
That's not what I thought you were going to say. After, if you don't like the quality of our voices,
then
piss up a rope.
To hell with you!
To hell with you!
Piss up a rope?
They probably wouldn't have said that back then. Well, they had rope, maybe, and piss.
They had rope and piss. Why not put the two together? And
my mom always told me something about pissing up a rope. Was it in the wind?
If only you could remember. Oh, well.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay, so Davos.
Oh, there's the chain.
There's a chain there.
There's Excalibur!
And a hot sword.
Hot-looking sword. They could have done more with this.
Yeah, what was your impression of... the whole speech about legends say of the hero that will draw the flaming sword and Stannis goes and does so.
I was still doing Skyrim stuff in my head while this whole scene was going on, like Talos worship versus the new gods. So.
That's really, okay, well you got that fundamental thing that Stannis is worshiping this new god and his old maester is opposed to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scene where he's pulling the sword out, in the book, it was very shammy, and it has the same feeling here. Whereas, I wonder if someone watching the series new, who didn't read the books, might just be like, "Well, this is kind of bullshit. I mean, this is not very anthemic or heroic or amazing." But I'm remembering back now to the book, and it was the same way. It was just kind of like people were dubious. Everyone was just kind of like looking around.
They did a good job. They did
a good job by not doing much.
They planted that impression of, oh, he's going to draw the flaming sword. Okay, he did it. And it's not flaming anymore. And then he walked away.
Stick it on the ground, walk away.
Yeah.
Davos is far more dashing than Angst, but he looks like Jean Reno, right?
Yeah.
who's the guy who played Theoden in Lord of the Rings? Anyway,
you tell us.
Bernard something.
Bernard something.
And Stannis, the guy who plays Stannis.
Well, Stannis has more hair than he should.
Stannis doesn't seem imposing enough.
No,
yeah.
He doesn't seem.
I mean, he was a
will
rock
enough.
In the book. He was
exactly.
Immovable, unflappable.
He's grinding his teeth and ready to bite anybody's head off at a moment's notice.
And he just seemed like whipping boy. Almost.
Exactly.
Ugh.
He seems too pliable and unsure of himself.
We'll see, though. It's an early blush.
That's true. But he just doesn't seem to be the badass that commands the room that we've come to expect from the books.
Yep.
Boy, they did a lot.
Isn't the maester, isn't it Pycelle? No,
that's Grand Maester Pycelle at King's Landing. Is it Maester Franken?
Maybe.
Well, okay, so that's another thing that I was curious about. Season 1 started with... Well, each of the books has a prologue chapter, and then is followed by a series of point-of-view chapters of sort of recurring characters. But every book has a prologue chapter where the point-of-view character is never repeated.
Okay.
It's sort of like an aside... A glimpse at something happening that all the other characters are unaware of, sort of.
Like the first one was the guy who was leading the sortie to go find the north.
It was a, yeah.
And he got cut down.
The Black Brothers on arranging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And two of them died, and you don't know what happens to the third until the next scene where you see Eddard Stark behead him for being a, for going AWOL.
Yeah.
And I think the prologue for... This book is the maester, like, doing stuff, isn't it?
Because the prologue for Clash of Kings? That's the second book, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
it depicted... It's from the point of view of that maester.
And he's a very old man because he's the maester who raised the Baratheon children, essentially. He was like the, you know, their teacher in the same way that we see Bran's maester at Winterfell, whose name escapes me. It'll come back. So Maester, I'm going to keep saying Maester Franken and
and be wrong.
Be wrong.
How
about Maester Smith?
Maester Franken is depicted as loving Stannis because he's been with him ever since he was a child.
Maester Cressen.
Cressen! Damn it!
Al Franken. Maester Cressen. Two different people.
Right. Maester Cressen, who is a senator from Minnesota. Former SNL cast member and writer. Maester Cressen. So the prologue chapter for Clash of Kings is from his point of view. And so it's sort of his thoughts establish who Stannis is and what his point of view is and who Melisandre is and what her deal is. I think they did a good job of depicting those things without getting inside his head, really. It was a little ham-fisted showing him drop sort of the pill in the cup of wine.
Yeah, it really went pretty quickly from that, from what it is in the book. It's like, you know, pages and pages of him, you know, deciding what to do, making this poison,
He was much more subtle about it. I mean, he really put some thought into it, but ultimately his goal was to poison her and kill her. But anyway, that was all the first thing. So I was wondering if, as they did with season one, if the prologue chapter would lead off season two. But they sort of buried the lead and had that. But which is fine. I think maybe it's more effective to jump right in with the characters that people remember. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the TV show.
Plus time constraints. I mean, something's got to give, too.
Well, true. I mean, they could have just done the same thing up front. But people would be like, who are these people and
right.
all that. I think they were better off having...
the comet and linking everybody together to where they are now.
Well, did anybody mention Stannis before they showed who he was?
See, that's the thing. That whole... Well, yeah, they did mention him earlier in the episode, talking about my brother and...
Rob's showdown scene with Jaime in the cage.
Yeah.
That did... No, it followed it because...
Okay, yeah. Maybe they didn't mention it before, I guess.
But maybe they showed Stannis in his situation, and then they have the confrontation between Rob and Jaime afterward to sort of reinforce who those people are and what their significance is.
They're not shy about throwing a big cat new cast of many characters at people and expecting them to sort them out, figure it out, remember.
And that's how the books are, too.
I mean, you're just like,
who's this guy? What's this chapter on Davos or whatever? It's like I've not been introduced to him.
20 new names in the last 100 pages.
You're in their head for a few pages before you know who they are and who they work for and what they're up to. They have been pretty bold in this episode, I think, in terms of establishing new scenes that are, like, you know, digest versions of events in the books. Like, you know, this basic story is the same, and the series of events is the same, but they're finding inventive new ways of putting two characters together and through their dialogue filling in the backstory of what's happening. And I think the scene between Robb Stark and Jaime Lannister is a good example of that.
That's not in the book, is it?
It's not in the book at all. Everything that happens to Robb Stark in the books is seen through Catelyn's eyes.
Yeah.
Because she was an established POV character. And so you're sort of seeing everything from her point of view and getting inside her head and seeing her take on things. So this is an example of really changing the story to a degree. Robb Stark is heroic enough as, you know, his story arc of going from the young boy who has to rise to the occasion of avenging his father and then rise further to the role of being the new king in the north and wage this campaign against this powerful rich family in the south.
He's not unlike Daenerys in a way, except for he's got a much more clear path that he has to take with no, there's no room for deviation, really. She's got the same responsibility and potential role, but she's pretty much just out wandering around the desert right now.
Well, that's true. I mean, he at least was always groomed for command,
right,
in a sense. Not to be a king, but to be a good lord and knight. But she was just a scared little girl on the run whose big brother was making all the decisions until he got a pot of gold poured over his head.
And if you make all usurpers responsible for their misdeeds, then she's probably the only one with a real claim to anything, right? I mean, she's the, quote, real
heir. She's the real heir to the true king.
But getting anyone to recognize
that. I mean, if you go back far enough, the Targaryens were usurpers in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, sort of. I mean, they were conquerors, and everyone, the seven separate kingdoms all bent the knee and forged Westeros, the kingdom, the seven united kingdoms, hundreds or thousands of years ago, depending on how you interpret things.
Who's to say that there's a rightful owner to the throne, you know, in life?
Well, the throne was forged of all the swords that were thrown down from all those that yielded to the Targaryens. So you could say, really, everybody who threw their sword down owns a part of the throne. So it's interesting that, so, yeah, they have heightened the character of Rob, so at the expense of Catelyn to a degree. So two interesting things happened as far as Rob Stark is concerned. First and foremost, they made it seem like he was calling the shots more than they did than occurred in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Because Catelyn Stark, since you always saw him through Catelyn's eyes, she always had an agenda when she spoke to Rob. She always had decided what would be the best course for him, and she would speak to him to influence him in that way. And one of the decisions he had made was to send Theon to go
The Rock.
To return to the Iron Islands.
Iron Islands, yeah.
And sort of, whatever, lobby his father to join
the side. Rally the ships, yep.
So in the books, that was depicted as Rob's idea, because he's such good buddies with Theon. Theon hadn't really been established as a fleshed-out character up to that point. But since later books prove him to be a more important character... not to spoil it for you, Phil, but Theon's going to live beyond this season. They made it seem like Theon was a little more scheming and telling him, hey, why don't you send me, I can bring the power of the Iron Islands to your cause.
Right.
Which is an interesting choice, I think. It's not out of character for him to have said that, and he very well may have had that conversation with Rob to lead Rob to decide to send him. But in the books, it's depicted as Catelyn goes to meet with Rob and discovers that this is a decision that he's made.
Part of this... Sorry. No. I was going to say, in the books, it seems more like when Theon... It's like he doesn't really have any thoughts of betraying Rob or doing anything against him until he, you know, goes back home, and then he's kind of...
Yeah, you have no reason to doubt Theon's loyalty.
Right.
For a long time.
I was going to say that part of this is just the, you know, age-old screen adaptation of a book. The authors or writers lose the tool of omniscience to be able to convey things to the audience by just saying, that's when so-and-so thought this. This is how this made so-and-so feel. You don't get that on screen. You have to extrapolate whatever they're thinking based on only on their actions.
No, you're right, exactly.
So I'm sure there was more... You know, what people were thinking in the book, and it was more laid out.
I mean, they're doing a good job of condensing.
There we go.
That's the one. Condensing the plot and finding inventive ways to add all the juicy details.
And nothing is wrong necessarily. Well, I take it back. I was just about to say, Rob sort of lecturing Caitlin that you can't just return to Winterfell to see Bran and Rickon.
Right.
I've decided that you're going to go south to treat with Renly. And she's like, oh, and then he has to explain, if Renly joins us, then we can end the war quicker, and that's how we'll get
she's just being
Arya and
matronly.
Sansa back. And she's being matronly, yeah. And she's like, oh, I just want my daughters back. Oh, I just want to go home. And it's true that those are the things that Caitlin wanted.
But that's really
but
her
in
idea
book,
in the book.
It was her idea in the book. Yeah. She made the conscious
that's
decision
true.
To go south. And she's the one who convinced Rob, surprised Rob by saying that she was going to do that. Rob was too preoccupied with the immediate battles and things and hadn't even considered that he could go treat mm-hmm. with Renly to end the war more quickly. So they've made a decision in the show to sort of raise Rob's profile and shrink her profile a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, she really turned around quickly in the show.
Yeah, it took him all of 3 minutes.
She's very defiant.
For her to be like,
oh,
you're right.
Your dad would be so proud of you.
You're so smart. what do I say when I get there? And who do I talk to again? What do I do? What am I going to wear? Oh, my gosh, so many things to do. Yeah.
I just want my daughters. The daughters.
They did a good job of establishing that dynamic of we have Jaime, but they have Sansa.
Right.
And they've lost Arya. And that whole scene of Tyrion strolling into King's Landing and everyone's surprised to see him.
Yeah.
And he does have that crucial but brief scene where he is playful and friendly with Tommen and Myrcella and then confrontational and condescending to Joffrey.
Yeah.
I mean, that's important to establish that he's not cavalier about everything, and he's a good uncle to his good
right.
nephew and niece. And
but yeah,
but he didn't smack Joffrey again like he's prone to do. But they did get a good smack in early on in season one.
Yeah. He that was a great scene early on with him and Cersei. He came back and he actually seemed kind of the charm that he has to the viewer, you know, where, you know, he's a good guy, he's mostly a bad guy, but kind of a good guy. It's hard to hate him, it's hard to love him. But he got a couple licks in on Cersei there, like, it's right out of the gate. Put her.
How does it feel to be the...
Anytime he makes her be quiet.
Disappointing
child.
Yeah.
That was
like
great
the,
scene.
The worst thing that he could probably say to her.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're worse than this terrible midget that nobody wants. Or, like, everyone blames for killing your mom and, like, all the stuff, so.
Yep. For sure. That was a highlight.
Sick burn.
And that's a highlight of that of A Clash of Kings, is those confrontations, those clashes between Tyrion and Cersei.
That's great. Rob and Jaime had similar, one of the few times that Jaime is really, really put down until later. You know, Rob got some good retorts, return retorts, however you want to call it.
Comebacks,
yeah. You know, return retorts.
Return retorts.
And
kind of
shut Jaime down. I mean, obviously he's in a, you know, in chains, but it's still hard to get him to shut up at all.
Staring at a CG wolf, nonetheless.
Nonetheless.
Well, that was great, and I mean, that was all that did was to establish that yes, the direwolves are getting bigger,
yeah.
And yes, Rob uses his direwolf as a menacing.
Rob is a lot fiercer in this season so far. It's only one episode, but he's pretty. He's fiercer.
I think his beard could be more fierce.
Well, yeah, he's...
It's not going to last.
All the other Northmen have way better
he's
beards.
He's a man grown.
All the young people in the show are a year older and fiercer like Joffrey. He was horrible before.
And now he's even worse.
Now he's even worse. He's less of a horrible, petulant child. He's still that, but he's now a horrible, petulant young man.
He's taller than his mother.
And he's smarter. He's playing, you know, I don't know if that followed the book exactly, but he's definitely more mature with his understanding of how things work.
He seems a little more, yeah, sort of run amok and in charge of things than depicted in the books.
Yeah.
I think he was depicted more, like Cersei sort of had him to heal a little bit more for a longer time than they're showing here.
Does she slap him in the book? I don't remember.
She effectively can cow him with a glance in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, Joffrey gets away with shit here and there frequently, and she gives him, like, a license to do quite a bit, but not to make sort of command decisions.
Right.
And so, I mean, in this episode, they made a specific point. After she slaps him, he puts her in her place. And he never did that in the books.
He didn't do that in the books, but also he puts her in her place, and he almost underreacts to her, you know. I think the other time when he was attacked by, who was it? By...
Anytime that he's attacked,
anytime
he physically cries and becomes weak.
Anytime he's physically harmed, he just, like, is shocked and doesn't know what to do.
But, yeah, his resolve is strengthened by this particular attack.
Yeah. But he does the adult thing of saying, you won't ever do that again, and doesn't do the childish thing of lashing back out, yelling, rolling around on the floor.
Or saying, I'm sorry, Mommy.
Saying, I'm sorry, Mommy, yeah. He just looks disturbed and threatens her.
They're undermining Cersei's character and building up Joffrey's, in a sense.
They are.
They're really playing up the sort of Robb Stark versus Joffrey element.
Mm-hmm. Or it might be a traditional medieval era battle of the sexes, you know, like power, as far as where the real power resides.
Does it strengthen the show for the screen to simplify some of these dynamics?
It might just be a necessity. Now I'm distracted.
Okay. There are flopping boobies on the screen at this point. Which brings us to our mysterious whore from the north, Tyrion's former favorite whore, and the one that Jon wouldn't sleep with because it didn't feel right. And,
weird.
Whose fault is that?
I shouldn't say Tyrion's favorite whore. This character perplexes me. In season one, they clearly established they were making a character out of this whore that Tyrion was sleeping with in the first episode.
She gets on the cart and says, I'm going
to
King's Landing.
Exactly. She's like, I'm going to move south and
move
try
to the
my
big
luck
city.
In King's Landing. Exactly. And so I just thought for sure the only reason for doing that is they're going to have her become the Shay character. Because it is, because the Shay character is the most important, influential whore character because of Tyrion and the influence that Shay has over Tyrion. But then they introduced a different Shay, and they just had her go and work for Littlefinger. So then I was thinking, alright, well, she's going to be the cipher for... is it Ala Yahya or whoever? The
Ala Yahya and the 40 Thieves?
Ala Yahya and the,
and the 40
Whores. Thieves. There was this whole thing in the book about how Tyrion, in order to make sure he didn't anger his father, who said, don't bring that whore to court, sets up Shay in an estate outside of the Red Keep.
Right.
And then the only way he could safely go visit her without being spied by Cersei's followers was he would go and visit this brothel run by Ala Yahya, who then would sneak him into the closet, into the secret tunnel that would let him go and visit Shay in her estate that he set up for her. But in the very first scene where we see Shay in this episode, she's in the chamber of the King's Hand, up in the tower of the Red Keep, looking out over King's Landing.
Just simplification?
Simplification, for sure.
No super plot.
But again, it's like, alright, so she's not, what, you know, if they're not going to do the whole Ala Yahya's brothel and secret tunnel subplot, what the fuck are they doing with that whore? What is the purpose of her character? Other than, you know, a plot thread, an excuse to show nakedness.
I'll take that excuse.
I guess, I mean, it...
Drown that kid.
That was, I think, one of the flaws of the show. Not that I have a problem with sex scenes or...
Prude.
Or... But they just...
It's just not really accurate to the book.
It's not
at all.
It's not accurate to the book. It just seems... What's the word?
Gratuitous?
Gratuitous, thank you. It just seems too gratuitous. Where there's plenty of great story opportunities to make it not gratuitous.
Well, again, it's still...
Gratuity on HBO? No way. they would never.
You got HBO for free for 3 months for this season?
Yep.
Kudos.
And thanks.
As did another friend of ours who is watching this show.
I don't know if you guys, any of you read The Oatmeal or know who that is online.
Yeah, webcomic.
Yeah, webcomic. But he drew a comic regarding the high unavailability of Game of Thrones after the season aired for people who wanted to revisit it. And basically he's like, I went on Amazon, they didn't have it. I went on Netflix, they didn't have it. I went on
Hulu,
they didn't have it. And he is hinting that, you know, the only place you could get it apparently was to buy it. And shortly thereafter, they cut the price in half.
Yeah.
Online. He's like, I'm not saying that this has anything to do with my comic.
Wasn't it a justification for downloading it off of BitTorrent?
Yeah, yeah. Where can we get this? Nowhere? All right. Go get it.
It was an anti-piracy message.
But putting the blame back on distribution and availability, you know, which, who's to say?
That's the power of HBO.
The power of HBO. This is CNN.
We're devolving.
Now we're watching credits, so I don't have anything on the screen to prompt me for anything else I wanted to talk about. What did I forget? What else is different from the books?
I don't remember. When they're north of the wall, when they go to the, I forget what the guy's place that they stay.
Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about Craster's Keep.
Craster.
But
Jon Snow doesn't come in and get insolent with him.
Jon Snow does not get chastised at Craster's Keep. Jon Snow is on his best behavior, for sure. But they did a very effective job of sort of establishing they've mentioned Mance Rayder.
Yeah.
And they
King Beyond the Wall.
That conversation between Lord Commander Mormont and Craster gave you all the information you needed to know as to what they were up to. The one thing it was lacking, though, was just how sort of downtrodden and sort of marching through the wet and the cold and just sort of how
bad it is.
Beleaguered those Black Brothers were by the time they got to Craster's Keep.
That's true. They were
and even though they talked about we've been to six villages and they're all empty, and he says, they've all gone north to serve Mance Rayder, the King Beyond the Wall. You know who he is. He's no friend of mine because he went AWOL from the Night's Watch, blah, blah, blah.
Burn cloak.
All the backstory you need, but sort of... They put all the flavor in there that was important, which is essentially, what's the deal with Craster and his daughters, and why doesn't he have any sons?
But
and the, just the grossness. Craster was way more pleasant looking than his character is depicted
with
in the
book. With a name like Craster, he can't... I mean, you're going to be way more ugly than that.
The episode ended with him there. It'll pick up with him there next time, and, you know, we'll see more.
Well, I wonder if it would... No, they have to establish Gilly, right? Or just, or do they only encounter Gilly later? Well, I think we met Gilly. I'm sure he was the wife that he grabbed and prompted to say...
To give the spiel.
Dutiful she was.
They didn't show, what's his name, being starry-eyed, looking at her and wanting to protect her and defend her already.
Sam. Sam has not met her yet.
No.
That's true.
But he could have right there. That would have been... I mean, I think they should have done something to where he, as soon as he met her, saw her, he was just like, you know.
When they first arrived at Craster's Keep...
He was really right for women, Sam.
Oh, yeah. He did say that.
Well, Sam, in an episode last season, says, I miss girls. Not talking to them, because I never did talk to them, but I miss looking at them. Sam is good.
Yeah.
The actor and the character. Good stuff. But so the establishing shot, John and Sam are talking to another Night's Watch fella who gives him the backstory of the daughters and how he marries his daughters and all that. Did they mention who that guy was?
I didn't pay attention well enough.
They didn't give him a name, did they?
I don't think so.
He could be just one of the guys.
They're pretty good about giving every... I mean, there's plenty of other Night's Watch characters that haven't been introduced yet that have that play a significant role. And
they'll probably show him again as one of the more major...
Yeah.
Because there's plenty coming up in that book with the Black Brothers.
There's several Black Brothers that have key things to do. And he might be... I'm thinking he's going to be one of them. But he didn't do anything unpleasant or inappropriate this episode. What about... okay, well, we haven't talked about Daenerys very much.
Not much.
I thought they did really an excellent job of establishing what's going on with her.
How bad off they are. And
it was really cool. For the first time, they illustrated the fact that she has her three blood riders. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, I think so.
Rakaro and the other two.
Blood of my blood.
Joho or...
Cool. They all have O's.
Well, Eerie and Jiki are the two...
Women.
Right. And then there's the other one from the Free Cities.
Right.
Who I think is still with her, but... Or did something unpleasant happen to her in season one, apart from being sort of molested by Viserys? Viserys?
Yeah.
Viserys.
I think she's still around, probably. I don't think she gets killed or anything.
I don't think she got killed either.
So she sends her blood riders each in three different compass points.
Yeah.
Go find out what's up.
They show the one horse drop dead.
Yeah.
Which there's plenty of other horses who drop dead, sort of, in the story. And
spoiler.
They're at the end of their rope in the middle of nowhere, and it's like, go find something for
anything.
Us.
Anything.
And she does give him a couple suggestive glances in the show.
Well, that's right. I mean, she has her little thing to Jorah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, that. You must be their strength.
Well, but...
As you are mine.
What Phil was saying, I agree, is from someone who hasn't read the book, so it looks like she was kind of... Flirting with those blood riders.
Like, if you ride northeast, there might be a little something in it for you.
Which absolutely was not the case in the book.
That was not that even all. Hinted at in the
but
book.
But it did seem that way, because there was a little smile there.
There's a tender moment.
Tender moment.
He is the something one who moved.
Snagged the poisoner in the market with his whip in season one. He was the only one of the three who was established from season one.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in the books it was well established that she had three blood riders of her own. And each of those had, like, a fabulous weapon that was one of her wedding gifts that she granted to them and so forth.
I'm not sure why they didn't try feeding the dragons horse meat. That would have been a perfect opportunity.
Well, they established she doesn't know how to feed them, they have to follow up and explain how she pulls that off. So you have that to look forward to. In case you ever have one of three dragons to feed on your own. They played up the character of Osha a little bit.
Yeah. Who apparently can't put her head straight on her shoulders because she is always has her head tilted.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Just an aside. Not sure
why. She's quirky.
Because she's quirky.
Animal. She's not courtly.
She's not courtly.
But, I mean, she does become a good sort of companion and
isn't she supposed
protector
to have taken her top off by now? I thought that was early on.
Does she take a bath in a pool and give Hodor a little thrill?
So we're going to get to see Hodor naked.
Or no.
We've already seen Hodor naked.
That already happened in season one.
Right.
We saw Hodor's member, and then she commented that he's got dragon blood, or giant blood, or something, right?
You know what they say about guys with giant blood.
Right up top.
No class.
Okay, so you were about to say something serious along the lines of she's kind of... warming up to...
Well, she's the one who says, you know, the Red Comet means only one thing, dragons. Which is a great sort of tagline to then cut away to Daenerys and her dragon. It's cool. I like the whole Red Comet. The Red Comet thing is extra cool in the books.
Because everybody takes a completely different
meaning
for it.
Everyone's got a different take, yeah.
Which they kind of get a little... They
get into that.
They said that in the show, but...
Back before they had science, you know?
It is kind of cool. One thing that comes across better on the screen is how you can actually show the comet and then show pan down to see who's looking at it. That's a real, we're all looking up at the same sky type of thing. Which,
yeah.
They still do it in the book, but it's just a new chapter and they talk about the comet. It's not as visceral as a tie-in, maybe. So.
One thing I liked was the scene depicting the scribe dictating the letter to Stannis that he was going to send out.
Yeah.
And how he kept correcting him.
He didn't F around. He knew what he wanted to say, no matter who cared.
That was a good character-defining moment for Stannis.
You kind of get that from the book, I think, a little bit. That he's kind of more like that than...
That's where he should have ground his teeth.
Phil, could you describe the table around which they were sitting in that scene?
It was very odd. It was
bumpy looking? But is that all you got out of it, right?
Yeah, I was trying to piece it together like...
You definitely spill your ale on that table.
Was this a table that they drug out of a war where there were cannons involved, you know? Like, it looked pretty beat up and...
They did not do table, which what they could have or should have done.
They really should have.
It's well described in the books that the table in whatever sort of the solar, or which is kind of like the inner sanctum of the lord of that particular keep or castle, the table is the shape of Westeros, the island or continent of Westeros. And, you know, sort of with the terrain and all that. A topographical table.
For the war room, just, you know, put down the pawns.
So my idea, one element of my dream that I failed to will into existence, was that they would use that table as the thing that the camera swooped over to establish where they are. You know, use that for the map.
That would have been great.
Like for the title sequence.
Will harder next time.
It would have been that much cooler, too, to swoop over it and show it all the time to establish where the characters are in season one, but you don't actually get to see it in real life in the setting of where it exists until season two.
I guess, but if you just so Westeros, Daenerys isn't in that at all, then.
Well, true. But,
Subtable. kids table.
That's right. One of the little sort of a TV tray off to the side.
With just a bunch of grass on it.
So I thought they did a bad job of establishing what that was, even though there's a lot of little things like that too, I guess. Like the whoever it was who was treating with Bran and Maester, what's his name?
Franken.
Not Franken. Shit. Great Maester. Look it up real quick, Mikey.
Crescent. Nope.
No,
Crescent, yeah.
Crescent's the one who was poisoned himself.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, let's go back to that. I was pissed off that it was apparent that Crescent had poisoned himself.
Didn't we already talk
before
about
she took a sip?
Oh, yeah, that's not how it was.
It was much more clever. Like, he took a sip, like, okay, I am killing myself, but I won't.
Or no,
I won't show my hand until she drinks.
Hadn't he, like, taken some antidote or something?
No.
Or...
He did not take an antidote.
For the poison
or she
he
went
just
first?
Drank?
He was sacrificing his life just for Stannis, because he loved Stannis so much. He was willing to kill himself to make sure that he killed her to save Stannis from his devotion
to
the new
played
priestess.
Himself.
It's not the best way to go about a poison.
But he's already dying from the poison. So
she's like, check this out.
Everyone in the room was like, oh, duh, he drank some poison. Yeah. No, you don't drink that. And she's like, okay, well, he's dying from the poison. I guess I'll drink this anyway.
She knew she was okay.
I mean, it's kind of like the Han shoots first thing a little bit. It's like...
But she was trying to prove a point afterward. Like, she could have... If she hadn't have drank after, the whole room would have thought she was more mortal than she maybe is or appears to be.
I guess, yeah. I mean,
she's still
got a power play out of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a little more blatant, like, yeah, I know it's poison, I'm going to drink it anyway, bitch.
No, I think that's exactly what the point was.
I guess so.
Lewin's the maester at a...
Lewin. Maester Lewin. Good old Maester Lewin. Giving Bran sage advice.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, the old guy that was treating with them mentioned something about when he was a young man watching them raise a tower in Torrhen Square. I just like the fact that Torrhen Square is a real location that has importance later in the story, mm-hmm. and they're just throwing in a little mention there. It's pretty cool.
And generic old man crabbiness.
Yeah.
You know, and earlier generations were always better.
If I give you some masons, will you shut the fuck up?
Yeah. When I was your age, we had an 18-year winter. You have it easy. Now it's just 5.
Ah. So, I mean, it was maybe established earlier, but do you get the significance of the longest summer and we're in for a 5-year at least winter kind of a thing?
Yeah, they were only drilling that through us all first season long of winter's okay. coming, you know.
Winter is coming. And now we know it's coming because they showed the White Raven. Right?
Hmm?
The White Raven? You saw that White Raven, right?
Was that yeah. a harbinger?
The White, yeah. I mean, Maester Crescent, or Grand Maester Pycelle was explaining that Old Town had sent out the White Ravens
that, yes.
because the sign, whatever.
The summer was over.
The Maesters had decided through their astrology or whatever powers.
How would you know, you know? How would you ever know?
Weather.com / Westeros.
What's a zip code?
I'll believe this winter when I see it is what I'm saying.
Well, that's another drag. Not only will it be a while before you see any dragon action, but like the first few snowflakes just start to fall in book 5. So you have a little ways to go. No, at least there things are well and snowy north of the wall.
Yeah, you can get your dose of winter north of the wall anytime. Well, all the time.
Fall's autumn. It's going to be a long autumn too. I mean,
a 20-year fall.
Autumn is coming. Not the same.
Get your fertilizer down.
All right, fellas. Well, anyone else with any more pithy observations for the season 2 premiere?
I guess the one thing, like, with Melisandre and stuff, at the when they kind of introduce all those characters, I mean, isn't it Stannis' wife that's really, like, kind of gets her to, like, come in? Originally, and then...
In a sense, they definitely depict her as sort of over gone off the deep end in her devotion
zealotry.
To R'hllor, the,
right.
Lord of the Light.
Lord of the Light.
But yes. I don't think we'll probably miss out on all that, I think, probably in the show.
Well, she was there, like when Stannis stormed off after
Is that who she walked off with?
But he, like,
with?
Forgot. Yeah. He walked off, like, and they kind of, like, looked at her afterthought and, like, okay, come on.
Yeah, no, it was which was a good little moment
yeah.
to kind of show just sort of how much he doesn't really factor his wife into his yep. designs.
Yep.
What about Melisandre? The casting.
She's
attractive enough, but she doesn't...
She was a little generic.
She was too generic,
she
right?
She was too generic. She didn't really have...
She wasn't charismatic enough.
She wasn't charismatic enough. She wasn't powerful enough. She wasn't sexy enough. She wasn't...
I always pictured, kind of like, an Angelina Jolie or something in that role.
Oh, yeah.
Will Harder.
She should have been... They could have had some more, like, tight shots on her.
What do you mean?
It's not okay. Let me rephrase that.
The jewel pulsing at her neck.
They could have had some more close-up shots of her and just have her having powerful speech.
Some reference to the fact how she sort of emits heat.
Yeah, or maybe exactly.
That might come later.
I think that
there will be ample opportunity.
Probably more when you're like with the Davos.
Yeah, but this is one thing that they cannot depict on the screen when you're talking about something that's tactile. You have to, if you're making a film or a TV show, you have to do what you can to convey that. And they've been talking about her putting off heat since the minute she was introduced in the book, I thought.
I think I read something to the effect that she was up for a different role on the show, and they liked her so much. She wasn't right for that role, but they thought of her for this role, and they're like, let's bring her back because she was so good.
Hmm.
I don't know, I just don't think she's that good.
She's just... compared to a lot of the other characters, she's a bit passionless, maybe. But, I mean, like, Rob is really, like, sticking it to people in this episode. Kat's kind of flying off the handle, and a lot of people are getting real up in arms. Joffrey's seething like a jerk face. Well, like, she could have at least been, you know...
They at least established who she is and what her role is. And maybe there's room for character development later, right?
Could be.
Like, in this episode, that's the thing I forgot to talk about earlier. They did a great job of establishing Cersei's desire, and it was that confrontation with Littlefinger scene. It's like, let's make sure that somebody goes out and kills all of Robert's bastards.
All the bastards, yeah, yeah.
Because they are the Trueborn, and my children are not.
Right.
Was the subtext.
Pretty...
And then that scene where they...
Serious scene.
Where Janos Slint pulls his dagger and kills the baby and the...
Yeah, we got into a little bit of baby killing. That's kind of controversial.
Nothing puts incest, a target on your head like I'm a villain. Like
incest, beheading.
Killing a baby with a dagger.
Infanticide, regicide, what's...
Drowning the kid.
Incest, what's left?
Throwing a... Or just carrying a dead baby by the ankles.
They didn't dash any babies' heads against a wall yet.
Yeah.
As described in the book from the Targaryens from way back when.
Indeed.
HBO even knows when to say when.
Or do they?
How else are you supposed to stop a baby from crying?
I'll get you. I have some books on that.
How to Murder a Baby, 101 Ways by Chuck Davis.
Dr. Spock's book that everybody in Raising Arizona keeps picking up. That's the one.
Well, we can't go out on that note. Let's talk about something else real quick.
Okay.
Well, I think we have a good lead into the next episode. Hopefully we'll get some... You don't see Arya the whole time until... You know,
right. They did a good job, and so that's what I was leading into. They show them killing off all the other heirs, and they show them torturing Gendry's.
Yeah, the blacksmith.
The blacksmith's apprentice's boss.
Yeah.
Like they're pushing his head into
the blacksmith's apprentice's boss? You mean the blacksmith?
The blacksmith. Right. They were pushing the blacksmith's head into the hot burning coals, and he says, oh, they went... And that's another scene that never happened in the books, but it does a great job of sort of explaining, yeah, okay, so that guy with the bull helmet...
That's who this is, for sure.
...is that Trueborn son, although, bastard son of the former king, who has gone off with the Night's Watch. I think...
What's the guy's name?
In the books, the blacksmith really had no idea what happened to him.
What's the Night's Watch guy's name? Starts with a Y.
Yoren.
Yoren. Yoren. Right, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yoren is the one who saved Arya.
Yeah.
And cut her hair off. And,
yeah.
And even that, at the end of last season, that doesn't happen until the second book.
Oh, really?
But they foreshadowed into that.
Yeah. That was one of the few second book scenes that they worked into season one.
Which is probably fine, because it was really...
It was important to establish that, and they ran out of time, really, to do it even in this episode. But they teased it at the end. It's like, oh, don't forget, this is where Arya is,
yeah.
And this is who she's with, and this is where they're going. And there'll be plenty of cool scenes with them later, and what they're up to. So they're off to a great start. I'm into it again. I'm excited.
Good.
And I'm excited to do it with you guys.
Oh,
relatively.
Not sexually.
We're still talking about podcasts.
It's
a body show. It should be a body podcast. Maybe not.
Put your pants back on.
Well, we can't leave on that note.
We are.
We're going to get body with our bodies. We'll be back next week. Join us again, won't you, for more Darkwing Storkworks.